Welcome, everyone. You're here at the tutorial call for the third time we're meeting for the Awakened World 2012 conference in Rome and Florence. Thanks for attending our third tutorial. The topic under discussion today is restorative justice. We're looking at the spiritual tradition of Judaism. And those of you who have been actually reading the tutorial, our audio interviews that you studied were with Rabbi Deborah Bronstein and Dr. Sally King. We also had a couple of the global manifestos that we were looking at this time. So you all have that background. And is there anyone here that has not been on one of our tutorials before? The way that you can indicate that, you can raise your hand by pressing 1 on your telephone keypad, and then I'll know who's new this time. So we just have 3 or 4 new people joining us, and the rest of you are veterans by now. Just briefly, the purpose of these calls is a little bit to build community so that we get to know each other a little bit before we actually meet in Rome in October. And also it is to get familiar with some of the themes and the topics and the people that will be so important to our discussions there. And with that said, I think I would like to invite Reverend Donna Burns to ask for a volunteer to do a centering prayer to open us into the discussion today. Donna, would you take care of
Certainly.
That?
Thank you, Barbara, and good evening to everybody. We always like to pull ourselves into our highest zone, and so at this time I'd like to ask for someone to volunteer to lead us in a brief centering activity. And as Barbara said, if you want to raise your hand, you do that by pressing 1, and we'll get this thing going. Okay, Barbara, you see a bunch of hands raised up out there?
No, nobody's volunteering, and I don't think I know who are ministers and clergy in the bunch, but I'm not gonna put someone on the spot. So maybe Donna, you could do that for us.
Yeah, let's do this because we're all here with a common purpose. So let's take a moment just to take a deep breath and just feel ourselves relax and put aside the activity of our ordinary day to open ourselves up to this extraordinary moment in time. Open ourselves up, mind, body, and spirit, to a higher knowing and a greater celebration of life and a coming together in a community committed to peace. And with one final breath, we are centered, and so it is. We're ready to fly, Barbara.
Thank you, Donna. Thanks very much. Right now, what we're going to do, we did this in our first call, and it was actually a lot of fun for people. We're going to divide you up now on the call into, just for a very short time, into small groups of 3 people each, and you'll receive a signal when it's time for you to begin, and this is just to introduce yourself to the 2 other people in your group. Get to know, because over the course of time, you'll be getting to know many people on the calls, and then you'll get to actually meet these people when you get to Italy. We'll make it a very simple format. We're going to do 2 rounds in this check-in. The first round is very simple. All you have to do is give your name and the location of where you're calling in from. And when everyone has done just that, then the first person should start again and take a couple of minutes just to talk about a little bit about yourself, your work, your family, why are you attracted to the conference, what are some themes that have special interest to you, whatever it is that comes to mind. And the only way we'll monitor you is that roughly a couple of minutes after that first person should be talking, we'll give you the sound of a bell, and that'll be your signal for the second person to do their longer check-in. And then 2 minutes later, the next and final person to do their final check-in. So I think that's pretty clear. And Megan, will we have a gong to begin the small groups?
Yep, we can do that right now.
Okay.
You are now in a breakout. Please begin.
Okay, I think we're all back. I hope that went smoothly and you got to know people that you hadn't really heard from before. So I think that we'll move right on because we have a lot of ground to cover today. I'm going to ask Jim to begin the discussion on our tradition today, which is Judaism, and we'll just continue from here.
Well, I'll just say that what we've done, because we want this to be an introduction, these conversations, to be a chance for people to get to know a little bit more about traditions other than their own or religious traditions around the world. So each week we're focusing on one, and this week the tradition is Judaism. And we've put together some basic materials that are available there on the website under the study section. And so for Judaism, let me just tell you what, I'll just read you quickly what we have there. First of all, a little description, and I want some of our participants to listen to this, because we are joined by Rabbi Deborah Bronstein from Boulder, Colorado, Rabbi Herbert Bronstein. They are father and daughter from Glencoe, Illinois. Also, Harold Kazimoff, former chair of the department, professor emeritus and chair emeritus of the Department of Religious Studies at Grinnell College in Iowa, all three experts in Judaism. So here's our little blurb. Judaism is the tradition grounded in the religious beliefs and practices and way of life of the Jewish people. It finds its anchor in the monotheism adopted by the biblical Hebrews. In this early period, there also developed a belief in the ultimate coming of God's kingdom on earth, a time of peace and justice. While not all Jews subscribe to the belief in the coming of the Messiah, many still hold to this ancient hope. Judaism is a religion and a civilization and culture that emphasizes the personhood of all its adherents, grounded in the trust in God's covenant with God's people. Observance is shaped by adherence to the divine commandments or expectations, which have both a ritual and an ethical character. And Judaism celebrates life and culture and enjoins its followers to the celebration of life's essential goodness and to service to humankind in the name of God. And then as we discuss each tradition, what we've done is to identify some excellence, something that the religion does best. For Judaism, we've identified this as a possible excellence. The most profound celebration of the holiness of every dimension of existence, of the oneness of the universal presence of God, the celebration of the wonder and richness of community. And some of what follows will sound familiar to Herb because he and I put this together. The master story of Judaism, what's the great story? And we do this for each of the traditions. In this case, Exodus and Sinai. A ritual pattern worth knowing about, the Seder meal, and an ethical norm that really fits with our conversation tonight, due justice. So I'd like to throw it open and maybe ask Herb and then Deborah and then Harold if you'd all care to comment briefly on some of these ideas.
Well,
how well do they work?
I could suggest, that was an excellent statement that was just made.
Yes.
And just a kind of now commentary on the word justice in terms of speaking about the motivation of justice as we see it first and earliest in the prophets of Israel, of course, Amos, Isaiah, Micah, Hosea, and so forth, Jeremiah certainly. And that is first motivated, I should say, because this is not well understood. If you read those texts, what motivates the demand for justice, equity, justice for all, is compassion, because the prophet, the teacher, saw the suffering from injustice, and as Isaiah puts it, God can't stand the suffering. It's something that is born, that suffering is born out of lack of compassion, and justice is restorative, to the acts of compassion that we should have. Secondly, justice is motivated by, yes, the preservation of order in society and a way of people living together. And finally, you mentioned it, it's through acts of justice and compassion that we build that better world that in liberal forms of Judaism is associated with the idea of the Messianic Age, a world, as you put it, of peace, justice.
Thank you very much for that. That's Deborah, do you care to add something? I hope.
I was just thinking about the beginning covenant of Abraham, the covenant that God makes with Abraham, that in the very beginning, God sets Abraham up to know what's going on in Sodom and Gomorrah. And God says, can I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? No, I can't. God says, I must show Abraham what I'm going to do, that he may teach generations, you know, afterwards how to do justly. And he sets Abraham up to argue with God, not to destroy this city, but to argue for 50 people, for 40 people, for 30 people, for 20 people, for 10 people, I won't destroy these cities. That Abraham learned how to argue with God against being unjust. That God become a quality of the Jewish people to argue against injustice.
Even the injustice of God.
Even the injustice of God. That if you can take God on, you can take others on when you see injustice. And that goes back to the very beginning of the relationship between Abraham and God.
That's terrific.
That's powerful, isn't it?
And Harold, can we entice you in Harold Kazimov from Grinnell?
I listened to the interview that you did with Rabbi Bronstein, and I agreed with everything. And I just want to add, I want to emphasize the point that she made. I'm happy she made, that she said the most essential teaching of Torah is the Talmud. And I think that's really very important because the Talmud is the single most influential text in Judaism. And for many centuries, when Jews studied Torah, it was basically they studied Talmud. This was in my own time, and when I began to study Judaism, I also studied only Talmud. The other point, I would add there's one emphasis that I would like to give to Judaism. In the Talmud, there's a discussion between two outstanding Jewish scholars on what constitutes the Klal Gadol B'Torah, which is the great principle of the Torah. And we know the statement by Rabbi Akiva, which is, love your neighbor as yourself. But another great Jewish scholar who's known for his saintliness, Ben Azai, said, this is the book of generations of man. In the day that God created man, in the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And it seems to me that since that time, the fundamental Jewish statement, the central teaching of Judaism, is that God created human beings in God's image. And I think what Heschel said, that would be the one thing he would teach if he could only teach one thing. And I just happened to come across, I was just looking at a book by Cabazon, actually, and in it I wrote down this very brief statement by a story by a Hasidic Rebbe who asks his pupils, thinking about human beings being created in the image of God, how could you tell when night ended and day had begun? And he answered himself, is when you can look on the face of any man or woman and see that they are your sister and brother. Until then, it is still night.
Wow.
Good.
Wonderful.
But those are the... and, of course, we know you began, when you began the interview, you mentioned that we cannot overestimate the importance of the Sabbath in the Jewish tradition.
Let me just ask, as we wind up, let me ask Deborah one quick question. Since, Deborah, you said the most important dimension of Torah is Talmud, just in case there's someone listening or someone in the group or who will listen later who's not exactly clear what the Talmud is. Can you give us a very brief explication of that?
Well, the Talmud is the oral tradition of Judaism that was it's a two-part incredible text that was compiled by the rabbis, the great sages, in the period of the early Roman period, and then period. There's two different answers to this question.
Mm-hmm.
One answer to the question is that the written Torah and the oral Torah were gifts by God to the Jewish people. The other answer to this question is that the oral Torah, the Talmud, is a text that was created, hammered out over generations, first by the early sages in the Mishnah in beautiful Hebrew, which was kind of Judaism that could be memorized and carried with one wherever they went, basic Judaism in all areas of life. And then the Gemara, the second part, was supposed, seemingly a commentary on that, but really a whole way of thinking, philosophy, details, all of it finished within, 400 or 500 years. It's a complex text which puzzles how we, who we are and what we're to do. And through the Talmud, we read the Torah and understand Judaism.
Okay. Thank you. That's very helpful. I think all of these comments. Barbara, do you have something to add?
No, I actually wanted to find out if there were any questions or comments by the people listening on the call.
Yeah.
Would any, once again, you can raise your hand by pressing 1 on the telephone keypad. It's a rare opportunity to have this level of expertise in our midst as we study these different religions. Each, we have a different religious tradition to study in each module, and we're trying to bring on guests to support the discussions that are considered to be high-level experts, obviously. So if you do have any questions at all, this would be the time to take advantage of this opportunity. Or perhaps they've done such a good job that we don't have any questions. So let's just move forward for now. I just wanted to briefly say that one of the aspects of our tutorial are the audio-video meditations that Association for Global New Thought produced. And the reason that this series was produced is because I want to remind us that one of the enterprises here is that the larger study of the changes in society that come as a result of our better understanding of other faith traditions and of other cultures is something that people of all traditions and cultures should be interested in. And sometimes, even though we're not expert on religion, there are ways that we can introduce our community to the basic precepts of all the different faith traditions in a way that helps people in their community to understand the people that are their neighbors. Sometimes this manifests at a local level. Some of the issues that we're fighting with at a global level these days is manifesting at a local level as well, that there is disharmony and unrest in local communities that is based on religious misunderstanding. And so in the Association for Global New Thought, for example, we have a lot of ministers and congregations who are themselves beginning interfaith programs. And so the video meditations are just one of quite a few sort of entry-level tools that allow us to see that when it comes to the basic concepts that define human society and the inner human being, that when we actually look at quotations from the scripture and literature of these various traditions, we start to see the commonality, what I call the highest common denominators, and it begins, the discussion of how we're more alike than we are different starts to come in. So I just wanted to say that and ask again if there are any comments on the meditation or anything at this point before we move on to the interviews. We have a question or a comment by Judy Colley. Please go ahead, Judy.
Actually, Barbara, it was I'm tagging on to your first question about the presentations from our guests today, our experts in Judaism, and I'm interested in hearing how they would give us some brief description of the delineation or the differentiation between the those who are the more Orthodox Jews and then those who are, I don't know how you describe, liberal or progressive Jewish expression in this time.
Thanks, Judy. Who would like to take that one?
Well, I could start, but I'd like to hear from the others as well. This is Herbert Bronstein. First of all, there is a, we could say in the, for the most part, that Orthodox Judaism hews more to received tradition in terms of practice, especially in terms of practice. Now, received tradition is a long process which ends up with codifiers, with religion as practice in the Middle Ages or in through the early modern period and today, even in dress, in manners, and strictness of preserving traditions that emerged in a certain time and a certain place. In all forms of liberal Judaism, which you would include the Judaisms of modernity, which would even include modern forms of orthodoxy, certainly Reform, liberal Judaism, Reconstructionist, other forms, there is the claim that the tradition has always, that the practice of Judaism has always changed. It's been open and available to all kinds of questions, and indeed questions are continuously asked and answers are given on how to behave in certain respects. So that the theoretical basis of orthodoxy is that the Torah was given to Moses at Sinai. That's the traditional idea, Torah le Moshe Misinai, in its entirety, both the oral tradition was passed to Moses, and then he passed it on, and along with it, exact ways that each leaders of generation should interpret or can interpret Torah, whereas all forms of liberal Judaism accept historical analysis, historicism, in the sense that Judaism, I won't use the word evolved, but we could, or changed in different places, different times, according to needs, whereas the basics remain the same. The basic outlook remain the same, but how you live it is changes.
Let me ask all three of you. I think that we have to tighten this. But can I ask all three of you, don't you think that what becomes explicit in Judaism with Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform, or Reform, we should say, Conservative and Orthodox, is there in a latent form or sometimes a hidden form in most of the great traditions, that kind of openness as opposed to sort of textual originalism and ritual originalism?
Yes, yeah.
Don't you think it's always there?
In religion as a phenomenon.
Yeah, the sort of liberal versus more conservative or orthodox interpretation. Certainly there in Buddhism and Hinduism and so on.
Important point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can I?
Yeah.
Perhaps it would be helpful to, since I studied text, the question I would raise would be, how do we see our sacred text? What does Torah min hashamayim mean, teaching from heaven? For the Orthodox, I would say, I mean, this would be very general in a one-minute statement. For the Orthodox, Torah min hashamayim, teaching from heaven, means that every word in the five books of Moses, definitely, is the word of God, that there's no human element. Moses does not have a share in shaping the the books of Moses. He is just an empty vessel. So that's one way of looking at tradition. If you look at conservative Judaism, revelation is a partnership between God and man, that the prophet is not just an empty vessel, he also makes a contribution. So the conservative movement is open to a human element in sacred text. So that gives you a lot of more room to maneuver. This is also true for the reform movement. I think it's even more so. The human element plays even a greater role than the divine element. And
I find that to be very, very helpful. Yeah, thank you for that.
So you can understand that if you have a sacred text, if it's all from God, if there's a human element, then there are certain passages about burning witches that you can say, this is just the human element, it's not a divine element. I mean, there are many problems. I'm doing it in 1 minute, but I think that could be one way of
that's
looking
very, very
at it.
Helpful.
Okay. So I think let's move on to talk a little bit more specifically about the two interviews that we looked at, because I don't want to run out of time before we discuss the two reports that we looked at this module.
Can I just say that it's very important to note in the context of the two interviews, the interview with Deborah Bronstein and with Professor Sally King. Sally is not with us tonight, but I spoke to her the other day and told her we'd be talking about this. And our theme tonight is restorative justice. And I'll just say very, very quickly, to put that in context, we could take a page from the book of the Walter Wink, a theologian that just passed away, a great theologian who wrote a series of wonderful books. One of the most recent was called The Powers That Be. Most of the titles of his recent books have the word powers in them. And he often spoke of the contrast between what he called redemptive violence and restorative justice. And he said those are two contrasting and competing stories. And most of human history has been dominated by the story of redemptive violence. It's the idea that some people simply need killing, and sometimes the only way to make a situation better is to do violence. Violence always for the very best reasons, always in service to some kind of justice and so on. And he says gradually we're getting over that older story, which fills our movies, our literature, and our political culture, and we're moving in the direction of a new story, and that's the theme for tonight, restorative justice. And I'll just say, Barbara and I are each going to say a word about the interview, and in Deborah's interview when we spoke back in 2010 about Judaism and justice, she said, the theme of justice has a consistent place in every text we Jews have. Throughout the tradition, there's a mandate for justice. She pointed out that in different generations, different aspects of Judaism take prominence, and that social justice has not always been the prominent aspect. In our generation, though, she argued, it has to be more significant or we'll be lost. And I think that's just a very powerful, that idea of social justice and the idea not just showing up and acting pious, as Deborah put it, but doing something for other people. This really points to the heart of restorative justice, social justice, doing something for the other. And that's one of the things that struck me most as I went back to that interview again.
Yeah, thanks. I really resonated with something that Deborah said in that interview having to do with moral choice. The idea that we're not programmed, that it is not as if we're predestined and have no ability to make moral choices. This is contrasting against the religious story of original sin, that it becomes a story of human choice. How we choose to form our character and conduct our ethics, that these are things that in terms of our ability to or our willingness to reflect what we believe to be the sacred or to be God, that part of this has to do with the own choices we make in relation to our own human character, that basically it's up to us. And so this notion of justice tied up with the idea of moral human choice is seems so much to be at the basis of conflict that's going on in the world today. And I think at this point I just want to ask a question of the participants. And here, the question that I'm asking, if you want to reflect on it and give us some feedback, since justice is so diversely applied in different countries and in different cultures, in different politics, in different religions, how do we actually come to an agreement about what is just as a global community? And how do you see this diversity playing out in your own community? So the question here is, since justice is expressed so differently in different cultures and different traditions, how is it that we can actually agree on what is a notion of justice? Does anyone in our caller audience want to venture a stab at that question? Anyone on our panel?
I'll just say that I think the key, this is Jim, and I think the key lies in this meditation on restorative justice, not the attempt to settle the books and punish the guilty, but to as much as possible to heal, to put back in place, mm-hmm. to give back.
Yeah, no, I do agree with that. I see that we have a couple of hands up. Marceline Cook?
Okay, I was thinking on something that I watched, I don't know if it was for this time or in trying to catch up on the others, there was something that I heard or read that from the basis for being just, and maybe it's in the Judaism piece, the whole sense of compassion, and all traditions have something to say about compassion, that notion of, you know, suffering peace or doing to others what you would want them to. So I think that can enter into the conversation.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you. And Ginger Charles had a commenter to make at this point. Ginger?
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I guess I would be speaking as a police officer. The concept of restorative justice is certainly a large topic amongst the judges around here, but certainly not popular around other individuals that look at this particular concept. The interesting thing about police officers, when they talk about how do we resolve the issue of the final justice and making things right, they most of them, no matter what their faith is truly resonate around the fact that they are doing man's justice versus the final justice, whatever that may be. I don't know if that actually answers your question, but that's a point of diversity within my community, within my work. But I do think that there are several within Colorado who are struggling with the concept of restorative justice and how that works. And one of the major factors is the lack of responsibility within specific groups in order to address that.
No, I actually think that's a very insightful and helpful answer. Thanks for that, really. Something to think about. One more comment, and we'll move on. Kay Lindahl?
Yeah, hi. I was just reading something the other day, and it just came to my mind when I was listening to the last two people speak. And it's about this notion that justice is something that we probably will never come to any agreement on. However, what if we looked at it differently? What if we transformed our conversation and looked at it as how do we end the suffering? How do we end the suffering here? How do we end the suffering there? And so there's something in that. I'm playing around with that in my mind right now, but there's something, a new place to think about how people suffer, which is the compassion issue, brings in the compassion as well. So just wanted to share that a little bit.
Thanks, Kay. And we'll take just one more for the moment, and that's Reverend Carolyn Wilkins.
Hi. Such a wonderful group to be sharing comments with. And I don't think I have an answer, but I have a bigger question, because the challenge of justice is not just cultures and traditions, but it's our idea of who can we actually be compassionate too, because in many countries and different areas, everyone is not considered on the same level. So by having caste systems and other systems and even our own U.S. Justice system, everyone is not considered equal. So I think that's even, that adds to the question of where are we? And when we look at ending suffering, the idea of ending suffering for those we don't think deserve it is what creates the conundrum.
Yeah,
one of the things that Walter Wink talks about, the theologian that I mentioned before, is that there is a sense of tribal justice and tribal bound justice, where, which is a kind of stunted and maybe even early evolving form, where we're perfectly inclined to do justice and do the right thing, however we define it, but only to members of our group, only to members of the tribe. And it's growing beyond those tribal frontiers and those tribal boundaries, and understanding that we extend justice to the stranger as well, and then gradually the stranger becomes the neighbor and the neighbor becomes the friend and so on. That's the true evolutionary process. And once again, Walter Wink does, I think, just an exceptional job talking about all that.
Jim, I think we should move on to the next
interview.
We're always so short on time, unfortunately, but...
Well, Sally King raises a really important and very controversial idea. Sally is professor at James Madison University. She is a scholar of engaged Buddhism, one of the key scholars of engaged Buddhism, engaged with social justice, in a word. She's also clerk of the Quaker meeting in Harrisonburg, Virginia. And so she addresses this as a practicing Buddhist and meditator and also a Quaker Christian. But this grows out of an experience that we had with the Peace Council, which will be very much involved in our Rome and Florence conference, which Sally and I both serve as trustees. We were in Jerusalem, and it happened to be Holocaust Day, and we were at Hebrew Union College and hearing about Holocaust Memorial Day and so on. And there were several Buddhists present, and one old Tibetan Buddhist who had been one of His Holiness's examiners, one of the examiners in the Dalai Lama's examinations, said that he just didn't understand this business of remembering and never forgetting and never forgetting. And he said, we Buddhists understand that we have to let go, and that compassion and non-attachment require us precisely not to remember. And Sally points out, she reflects on that. We were both in the room, and she reflects on how that moved her. And she says that, as a matter of fact, in Buddhism, the idea of justice doesn't get anything like the airtime and the attention that it gets in say, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And it's a concept that many Buddhists find rather elusive. And she goes on to point out that from the Buddhist point of view and from her own point of view, often when Westerners talk about justice, often enough, they're actually talking about revenge. And that revenge does not restore justice. It's not restorative justice. It's much more closely related to redemptive violence. So it's just her point is that often when we talk about justice and think we're really active on behalf of justice, it's really redemptive violence or revenge that we're getting at. And it's just reminding ourselves that that's the story we can leave behind as we move to a much more evolved story of restorative justice. I mean, Sally certainly credits the idea of restorative justice and thinks that's an evolved and healing notion. But it's a very interesting caution. Are we really talking about justice, or are we deep down sometimes talking about revenge?
Yeah. So based on Sally's interview, I have another question for the participants. It could be said that righteous judgment and victimhood, think about that for a moment, our tendency to be righteous in our judgmentalism of others, and also the notion of victimhood seem to go hand in hand in our society. And I wondered if any of the participants or any of the panelists have any anything to say about how they have experienced this in their own community or in their own lives?
That's a very good question.
Would anybody like to muse on that out loud a little bit? Victimhood and judgmentalism.
Is it Ginger?
I think Ginger has her hand up again. Go ahead.
Yes, I hope this isn't boring, but just, again, coming from the world of law enforcement, certainly we classify people as victims, suspects, witnesses, and what I see really happening with that particular title is that we really limit people, and then we don't grow beyond those particular titles for them. So it makes it very difficult to get in touch with the human being, rather than, you know, just seeing the role in front of us. So I think that's probably the best thing I can tell you about victimhood, that I see limits us in our abilities to actually connect with the human being that's in crisis or whoever's in crisis.
I think what's interesting about that, this is Jim Ginger, and what's interesting about that is that you're talking about how your own, in law enforcement, your own ability to connect with the individual is hampered by the need to put these sorts of labels, the victim, the witness, and so on. But it's also instructive to think about what happens when we put those labels on ourselves, especially the victim label.
Absolutely.
And that keeps us not only from seeing ourselves, but from seeing the other. Seeing the one whose victim we imagine ourselves to be, and maybe, in fact, we are. Can we ask, Barbara, do we have time to ask if any of our panelists just has a very quick observation before we move on?
Yeah, absolutely. I would just like to comment that it's encouraging to me that there are people in law enforcement like Ginger that are actually consciously thinking through these questions. But certainly, let's ask for some comments from our panelists.
And I like it that she's in law enforcement in my home state.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think why don't we go move ahead now and talk about the Bratt Report and Toward a Global Ethic, because I bet that the people on the call and our panelists will have a lot to say about that.
Well, I'll just jump in and say that one of the things that from the beginning, since we decided that we would try to craft together in preparation for our gathering in Rome and Florence, try to craft a charter for engaged spirituality in the 21st century. What are we calling for in each of the four domains that you're becoming familiar with? The first is reconciling with the other, and then transforming society, and then embracing the earth family, and finally rediscovering the sacred. And what are we calling for as we think toward a future of spiritual engagement in the 21st century? And so we thought it would be really interesting to reflect on the fact that there have been a number of very significant, very powerful, very influential charter documents, declarations, global statements, and so on in the past, because very often people will raise the question, what do you think you're doing when you come up with a charter or a statement or a gathering, a declaration from a gathering? And actually there have been some enormously influential such documents. And we have two of them on the docket tonight, and we are really fortunate with our guests tonight. I was delighted to see my friend James Quilligan show up. Hello, James. You're out there in the group. And one of the first document we want to talk about is the Brandt Report from the early 80s. And James was involved in that from the get-go. The Brandt Commission that was put together under the tutelage of Willy Brandt, former chancellor of West Germany. And that really began to raise world awareness in a couple of seminal reports, one in 1980 called North-South, I think, and then another that came out a few years later, 1983, called Common Crisis. But the Brandt Commission of very distinguished persons from around the world called the world's attention to the problems of sustainability and economic development, and especially to the great divide that was developing between North and South. And to the extent that that's a big part of our worldview today, the global north, the global south, the rich north, the poorer south, and that has come to shape our understanding, well, of restorative justice for a lot of people that work to make the world a better place. I think we have the Brandt Commission report to thank for that. And I should just tell you that that James Quilligan is responsible for the Brandt equation, which is an attempt to look back two decades and more and say, okay, what did the Brandt Commission set in motion and where are we now and how do we take stock? And the subtitle of the Brandt Equation is a 21st Century Blueprint for the New Global Economy, and you can find that online, the Brandt Equation. So I just wonder if I could call on James first to say something, to say just a few words, since there's no one around that knows this conversation and this document better than he.
Hi, this is James Quilligan. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, great. Jim, that was a good introduction. I would add that one of the lingering themes now that is still resonating very strongly that came from the Brandt Report is about the monetary system, the need for monetary justice, and we're reawakened to that as a result of all the difficulty that's happened since the 2007-2008 crash, and then the subsequent events, particularly the what's happening in the European Union now. Restorative justice is a big part of what the Brandt Commission was talking about. I think that the conversation has not evolved too much further beyond what the Brandt Commission actually proposed. The Millennium Development Goals were simply a rehashing of the basics that the Brandt Commission had talked about. Actually, they were kind of a watered-down version. And unfortunately, the Millennium Development Goals, most of them have not been met, and now the world is facing another kind of shortfall in which we have to redecide at the international level whether we want to update the Millennium Development Goals or conceive of something entirely new.
Just for people who are listening, the Millennium Development Goals of the United Nations promulgated in 2000 and initially setting, right, James, a target date of 2015.
Right.
So maybe as we're headed toward the top of the hour now, I don't want to leave this without having some mention about the document Toward a Global Ethic, because some of us on the call were very involved in that document as well. So, Jim, it's terribly abbreviated because there's so much more to say about all of this, but do you think that you could describe that a little bit for us?
I think I can do it pretty quickly. In 1988, when we came together, and Barbara and I were both very involved in this, Herb Bronstein was involved in this, many others on the call attended or played a role in the 1993 Parliament of the World's Religions, which brought together 8,000 people from around the world to Chicago to talk about how religions of the world could work together to address the critical issues facing the world in our time. And one of the features of this event was a gathering of between 250 and 300 religious and spiritual leaders, very prominent leaders from various traditions. And so back in 1988-89, as we contemplated that, we began to wonder, well, what do you do with 300 religious and spiritual leaders whose attention you have for a very brief time? And the result was the drafting of a document. It was drafted by the Swiss theologian who had spent a lot of time talking about the issue of whether or not there is a shareable set of ethical principles to which all of the world's religions could give their assent, and that's Dr. Hans Küng, K-U-N-G, and he wrote a draft document called A Global Ethic, which eventually was modified, edited, and finally approved by a majority of these 300 folks that attended the parliament as religious and spiritual leaders. And it identified very quickly four principles: commitment to a culture of nonviolence and respect for life, And then these principles are elaborated on in the document. Commitment to a culture of solidarity and a just economic order. Third, commitment to a culture of tolerance and a life of truthfulness. And finally, and this one was far and away the most controversial, commitment to a culture of equal rights and partnership between men and women. It was a lively 3 days of discussion of this document, and eventually it was approved. And for those that wonder whether conference statements and conference declarations ever have legs, do they ever matter, the global ethic has been very much alive. It has spread around the globe, and it has been energizing and animating conversations, some critical, some positive, but a whole range of conversations ever since. It's an extraordinary contribution to the global conversation. Mm. Even when people don't like it or don't think it went far enough, it still gets them talking. So it was a very important event.
Maybe we have time for anyone who wants to answer or make a comment on the question that is on many people's minds, including my own, whenever I read these declarations and proclamations, is that over time we've seen and explored so many of these important papers, and we continue as a whole to wonder if we've seen any direct correlation or shifts in behavior by populations, by governments, by political systems, by economic systems. It's one thing for religious and spiritual leaders or people in good faith or people who are part of consciousness studies or a movement in general to basically agree that all of these things are good ideas. But I think the big leap is how do we move this agreement about a better way to behave and a better way to think, how does that actually get seeded into the structures, the institution, the systems that actually have the power to determine how things go in our societies? I get a little passionate when I think about this. You know, can we actually make it across that boundary of what we believe is right and true, and will the institutions and system actually have any interest in perpetuating a better way of governing?
For me, it's a different dynamic. It's not trying to break through at the top. It's breaking through at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And I think absolutely critical here is understanding the nature of cultural evolution and understanding the nature of a movement. On the day after the March on Selma, it was the wrong question to ask, okay, what have you done about segregation? The movements grow, and they do not descend from the top down. They grow from the bottom up. And we can't ask, how did this document make a difference? But we can say, how do we think differently about justice and about some of these issues today from how we did 20 years ago?
I have to completely agree with your point, because we've got a program called the Gandhi King Season for Nonviolence that definitely looks at how the grassroots can, in local communities everywhere, change the consciousness and behavior of the community, which basically amounts to global change. So I have to say I agree heartily with that. How about some comments from our callers or today, our participants, or from the people who are on our panel? Okay.
Fred.
Let me see. Fred.
I'm here. Am I here?
Yeah, we can hear you. Go ahead.
This is so far out for me. I'm fascinated. There's a couple of things that we have bounced off that I think, based on the people that are going to be there and what we're attempting to do, might be worth at least pointing out about justice. For one thing, I'm a big fan of Walter Winks, and I'm glad you brought him up. I think he's done the most, some of the best work around some of these very, very difficult issues. But frankly, there's a certain point in many of our global justice issues and even local justice issues where resolving a justice and bringing about justice for one ends up feeling like, and often is, an injustice, or certainly can be interpreted that, for another. Mm-hmm. And I just think some of these challenges are need to be, I don't know if it means to be addressed or at least held in our thoughts. And I won't go into any examples right now, but there's many of them. The other thing that was touched upon briefly by Ginger, I think it was, is the final justice or the final solution. There's a lot of different terms for it. Often comes from out of the more conservative, particularly Christian. I'm aware of that probably better than any. But it's also, to some degree, part of the Buddhist tradition in karma. And that is, well, it may not work out fair here for people, but when they get to that next place, then everything's going to be just fine. And so when you're dealing with religious organizations that believe in a life after death kind of thing, where the good people get to go and the bad people don't get to go, then there's going to be justice for everybody. And so a lot of times, and as we know historically, that's been sold as you know, you just ignore what's going on now because there's this other thing coming. And that's been with everything from the way we divide human beings up, the tribal things that occur, but it's also and more recently been part of the thinking on some of the more I'm going to say conservative, and those terms are need to be fleshed out, but with the whole ecological thing. So let's not worry about this earth, because at some point we're going to be in the beautiful place. So you know, and I think it ties into the whole Jewish tradition of everything is divine, and of course those of you that know me know that's the way we've taken the whole Christian position with progressive Christianity. But anyhow, I just think these are issues that we don't have time tonight, but they need to be at least addressed.
Thanks.
Very good. You know, this is Rabbi Deborah Bronstein. I'd like to share a reflection that I've had in listening to all of you. I really think that there are people who are victims of horrible events, and it's not a bad word to say that someone has been victimized. And I think that happens when a person is not seen as a being created in the image of God. When one person can see another person as an object of whatever they want to do to them. And that justice comes when everybody becomes persons to each other again. But it doesn't happen just in an easy way. There's a lot of restoration that needs to be done before people become people to each other, until there's one individual looks to another as a person. And I've been thinking a lot during this conversation about the young people from South Sudan who've come here to Boulder, and the kind of trauma they've carried with them as people who've lost their homes and families at the ages of 2, 3, 4, and 5, and who've developed a way of living here. Two of them have returned to their home several times and risked their lives to bring medical help. And so they've not only worked to heal their own trauma, but to go back and save lives. And in that way, they've transcended one part of their life and helped transform themselves and other people. And I think that we shouldn't cavalier about we can't make the world nicer than it is, that there are horrible things that happen and that restorative justice takes a lot of work. And it takes a lot of work to move from being a victim of something terribly unjust or world ending. And it takes a lot of work to come back to being able to be a healer oneself, and that we all have responsibilities to put our hands forth in compassion and justice to help others.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and that's one of the reasons that in every way, every single individual, every single community, those of us here on the call, those of us who go to these conferences, read these books, go to the workshops, we're here, and this is the state of the world, and we can hold a higher vision and at the same time get to work on the ground, because, you know, in acknowledgement of, you know, history of human suffering, it doesn't mean that we're doomed to constantly recreate our past mistakes. You know, I, as an individual, want to believe that we have, as you said in your own interview, we have the human choice to subscribe to a higher moral order, and we actually have the responsibility, but also the opportunity to make the society better than it's been in the past, and instead of just repeating all the bad things that we've done in the past. So I'm trying to maintain optimism sometimes in the face of great odds.
Yes.
So, Jim, is there anything more that we should wrap up here pretty soon? Is there anything more that you would like to add at this point?
No, I'm grateful for Deborah for helping us to end on that note. I don't think anyone here is cavalier about any of this stuff, but I think it's really important to hear about it in such concrete and still hopeful ways, because what you just said, Deborah, is filled with hope, but also the challenge of hard work. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
So thank you, guests that came on the call today, and thank you all of the conference attendees who attended today. We'll meet here again in 2 weeks. The fourth module is the theme is compassion, poverty, and migration, and the video meditations on compassion. The spiritual traditions we'll be looking at next time are Buddhism and Jainism, and it's appropriate when we're talking about compassion, poverty, and migration that one of our interviews is with Dr. Nawan Phuntsog, who's a Tibetan Buddhist, and then a member of the Peace Council from Mexico, Father Gonzalo Ituarte, that Jim can tell you more about on our next call. And also I wanted to remind you all that tomorrow we're beginning our brief teleconference Italian lesson with Silvio Dagno, who's our Italian logistics coordinator, who lives in Rome. And we have, if you haven't seen that email and signed up for the call, he's going to give time every 2 weeks to give us a brief Italian lesson so that by the time we get to the conference, we'll have some useful phrases that we can deliver there. So I guess that's about it. And
thank you, Jim and Barbara.
Thank you, Herbert.
For
thank
all you. The work that went into this.
Oh, thank
and
you
thanks,
for being here.
All of you. Deborah and
thanks,
Harold and Herbert Bronstein and James Quilligan, thank you all for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Okay, good night. Have a good evening, everyone.
Good night.